Last week I began a sermon on godly finances and only managed to get a number of points done, 3 points, so I didn't even finish the final point that I was dealing with. But more and more, the trigger looks as if it may well be economics, the trigger that will bring about the end time events. And I gave the example of Greece, and I read that article in the Telegraph last week about how Greece, it is actually when, not if. And what happens if Greece defaults? And it gives a list of things that if Greece was to default, where every bank in Greece will instantly go insolvent, the Greek government will nationalise every bank in Greece, then the Greek government will forbid withdrawals from Greek banks. And it was actually listing out what in fact would take place, and how the new drachma will then devalue by some 30 to 70%, probably around 50% or more. The Irish then will, within a few days, walk away from the debts of its banking system. The Portuguese government will wait and see whether there's chaos in Greece before deciding whether to default in turn. And a number of French and German banks will make sufficient losses that they no longer meet regulatory capital adequacy requirements. And then the European Central Bank will become insolvent, giving its very high exposure to the government, Greek government debt, and the Greek banking sector and the Irish banking sector. And so it's then having this domino effect throughout the entirety of Europe. And from chaos that would actually take place within the world at such an event such as this, the beast power is very likely to arise. And remember, you're looking at 10 nations or groups of nations or kings or kingdoms or whatever these kings are, whatever these kings are over, that would give their power to the beast. And that power is undoubtedly going to be fiscal power as well, so that they will be able to actually have one common currency, and that common currency will have some teeth put with it as well. And I pointed out that in this chaos, here we are preparing for the world tomorrow. And preparing for the world tomorrow in a fiscal way as well. It's not just in our own spiritual lives, but also part of that spiritual life that we have is how do we manage our money? How do we manage the what God has given us physically? And can we then teach a different way of life that will bring about a different financial system within the world tomorrow? And as I said, that the heart and core of the problem is covetousness, that the entire system is built on debt, and debt is a form of covetousness where you're wanting something, you haven't got the money to pay for it, so you buy it anyway, and then you borrow the money to be able to do it, and therefore there is a form of covetousness there. So basically what I was going into was the fact that God isn't the author of confusion, that we do in fact need to be ready for the world tomorrow, and we do need to learn now God's way and actually go against the flow. The areas I was planning to go into, and the two areas I actually went into first of all, was the fact that God does what is right. If you remember, that whenever God does something, he does what is right. And if in our financial and our fiscal budgeting and so on, if we need to try and reflect that same mindset, and as we buy things, as we spend our money, we need to ask ourselves, is this right? Is this the direction in which it needs to go? Secondly, God works to give, and he does work, and certainly does work. Thirdly, God only gives what is his, and that's the one where we actually came to last week, and we actually managed to get about halfway through. And fourthly, the fact that God accounts for his accounting system is literally down to the atomic level. He accounts for every atom, even the presumably the quarks and the muons and all the rest of it within the atom are all in balance, and everything does balance. And certainly the atomic, we wouldn't have any chemistry, and the chemistry that we have today couldn't work unless there was this balancing, this accounting, that matter can neither be created or destroyed within a chemical reaction. That's the very basis. If you go do any chemistry at school, the basis of the first law you learn is that matter cannot be created or destroyed in a chemical reaction. So you can write a chemical equation. You know that there's so many atoms of this and so many atoms of the other, and then they combine together to make so many a molecule which will contain exactly the same number of atoms, even though energy is being shuffled around in the process. You know, if something burns, then it forms the carbon combines with the oxygen, makes carbon dioxide. But he accounts for every atom, and also finally, that God plans ahead. He budgets. He looks ahead. He is the world's greatest planner, and certainly the holy days teach us that. But if we are going to reflect what is right, then we also need to be knowing where our money goes. And we also need to know and plan ahead in a budgetary way. So as far as the first point was concerned, the key scripture I used, if you turn over to Luke 16, just to recap very, very quickly, the fact that God does what is right, yes, but he's also teaching us that it says in verse 8 of the after the parable of the unjust steward, in Luke 16, it says, "For the children of this world," and this is the purpose of the parable, is telling us about the carnality that is there, "but the children of this world are in their generation," the generation that they live, "wiser," craftier, in other words, "than the children of light. And I say to you, make to yourself friends of the mammon of unrighteousness," and in other words, use the money that we've been given, use the physical resources that we have, "that when you fail," in other words, when you die, "they may receive you into everlasting habitations," because you've got friends, you've conducted yourself in such a way that you're part of what God is doing, the actual kingdom of God. You're there in the kingdom of God with people that you know also in the same kingdom of God. "He that is faithful in that which is in least is faithful also in much. He that is unjust in least is unjust also in much. If therefore you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who's going to commit to your trust the true riches? And if you've not been faithful in that which is another man's, who is going to give you that which is your own?" And we will in fact have what is our own eventually. And we will have everlasting dwelling places, it says, you know, that they may receive you into everlasting habitations. And certainly we look forward to that kingdom, to that membership of the very family of God, and the rulership that we'll have at that time, and the relationships that we'll have at that time. And it has an impact on how we look after our money today, how we use our money today. Now, the fact is that God works to give. He doesn't, you know, put in your notes, John 5, verse 17, that the Father works and I work, I brought out. But the key verse that I turned to is Ephesians 4. In Ephesians chapter 4. And here we see that there is a principle given. Although it's talking in verse 28 about "let him that stole steal no more," it's not just a thief that he's talking to, because it's saying here is a principle that Paul himself brings out in 2 Thessalonians 3, and gives his own example when he talks about how he used to work as a tent maker. But here in Ephesians 4 verse 28 it says, "But rather let him labour, let him work, working with his hands the thing which is good." And those hands may be on the keyboard doing whatever necessary, or you could be out there shoveling, digging ditches, or it could be going ahead and being a carpenter, or whatever our work is. It says, "working with his hand the thing that is good, that he may then have to give to him that needs." So you've actually got something that you can then give, that you can share, that you can, again, make friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, are able to, therefore, pay our way in this world, not sponging off other people all the time. And we need to make sure we do try and do that. God works to give. So part of the process of doing what is right, as far as mirroring what Christ and the Father are like, is that we also need to be working. Now, in giving, going on to the third point, we need to understand that God only gives what is actually his. He doesn't have to go out and borrow something. And let's just look at some of the scriptures. So we're coming into a new section now. Say we're picking up from where we left off before, but let's turn over to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. And we will see the planning involved, and make careful note of the planning involved. It says in Daniel chapter 7, where he's talking about the kingdoms of this world and all the Gentile kingdoms and how it goes all the way down to the end time. And it says in verse 26, it says, "The judgment shall sit, and they'll take away his dominion to consume and destroy it to the end. And now we're watching the economic collapse within the world. We're seeing it as a trigger that will actually bring about the ultimate rise of Europe. And that power and dominion of the rise of the final resurrection of the European beast power, the European economic system that is there, will ultimately be destroyed. It says we'll take away his dominion to consume it and destroy it to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdom and the whole heaven. So that whole kingdom is going to be given up. Includes the fiscal kingdom. That includes the money, includes the wealth, includes the mines, includes everything that is brought out of the earth, the farms, everything that is involved there, shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. So they will actually, but no, I want you to notice, it will then be given to them. Now, how can it be given to them? Because ultimately God owns it. God is the one that owns that kingdom. The European Union is going to bemoan the fact that there's a destruction of the system at the end time. But you know, God owns it. God's made the decision as to who he gives it to and who he doesn't give it to. And he's allowed it to have this final resurrection to teach us certain lessons. And aversion therapy is a key lesson that needs to be understood by everybody, well, every single one of us. If we turn back to Psalm 24, we see how it is that the entire wealth of the kingdom is going to be given to the saints of the Most High. And we will be given that wealth, and to then administer that wealth, administer it in a different way, in a totally different approach from what was there before. And what God is giving is from him, from his own resources, because he can give it to whoever he wishes. And here in Psalm 24, it says, "The earth is the eternal's, and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein," everything within this earth, everything that we count as ours, is the eternal's. So all the money that we earn also is the eternal's. And therefore, if it's going to be ours, we've got to make sure that we fit within the eternal's instructions. Then the money becomes ours. If it doesn't fit within the eternal's instructions, then it's not. As we see, the beast power will be destroyed, and the entire power, the entire wealth, everything else will be given to the saints of the Most High, who are then ready to administer it properly. And that is the key, that within this corrupt system that we find ourselves in today, we have got to be ready to administer that government correctly, because it is from that government that is flowing down from God the Father through Jesus Christ into his church, yes, and into the actual way of life of all his people, that will then be extended across the entire earth and give the stability, the glorious liberty of the children of God. That's what will be given. So the earth is the eternals and the fullness thereof, the world and all that dwell therein. For he has founded it upon the seas, established it upon the floods. Who shall ascend to the hill of the eternal? Or who shall stand in his holy place? He that has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted up his soul to vanity or sworn deceitfully, he'll receive the blessing of the eternal and righteousness from the God of his salvation. So the entire earth is given to, is God's, but you know, who's going to ascend to his hill? Who is going to go and be part of that government? Who is going to be one of these saints to whom the entire wealth of the world is going to be given, is going to be entrusted? This is the generation of those that seek him, that seek your faiths, O God of Jacob. So this generation, and it says Salah, it says, you just think about that. This is the kind of people, these are the kind of people we're talking about. These are the kind of individuals, the spiritual qualities. And the spiritual qualities that we've got to apply to our personal finances. Spiritual qualities that we give what is ours, what is entrusted to us. God puts a certain amount of wealth in our hands, and he himself will give from his own resources. As we'll see, he accounts for those resources very carefully. But he will give, and so must we do the same. Lift up your heads, O your gates, and be you lift up, you everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. And it's almost like likening these people, this is the generation of them that seek him, that seek your face, O God of Jacob. And lift up your heads, you gates. These are the gates and that will prepare the way that Christ will come to, and with the Spirit of God, which will then have this administrative government that will extend across the entire earth. Who is the King of Glory? The Eternal, strong and mighty. The Eternal, mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, you gates. Lift them up, you everlasting doors, and the King of Glory shall come in. Who is the King of Glory? The Eternal of Hosts. He is the King of Glory. Selah, think about that. That he's going to come back as the King of Glory, and it is, it's who's going to ascend to this hill? Who is the one that's going to ascend to his governmental structure? Who is the one that is then going to take that power and the glory and the dominion of everything? And he will give it to the saints of the Most High. And it says, he that has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted his soul to vanity, nor sworn deceitfully. And this, as I said right at the very beginning, that this covetousness lies at the very heart and core of the world system. The entire core is based on debt. And if we don't get our ideas and concepts sorted in such a way that we're working on a cash basis where at all possible. Now, as we'll go in and see, there are exceptions to that in today's society, but they're not really exceptions to that. When we go and really understand them, we'll come on to that. So this psalm in chapter 24, shows not just that the earth is the Eternal's and the fullness thereof, but who is going to be involved as saints of the Most High in the future, as that is going to be administered and administered properly. Turn over to Malachi chapter 3. Malachi chapter 3. Because there is a principle, and this principle is found here in Malachi 3. It says in verse 6, it says, "For I am the Eternal, I do not change." He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And the one that says that is the one that became Jesus Christ. And he doesn't change. He's the same God from way back as he is today, as he will be in the world tomorrow, as he administers his way and his mindset. "For I am the Eternal, I do not change. Therefore you sons of Jacob are not consumed," because it's all part of his plan. "Even from the days of your fathers you have gone away from my ordinances. You've not kept them. Return to me and I'll return to you," says the Eternal of Hosts. But you said, look, how are we supposed to return? What are we supposed to do? "Will a man rob God? And yet you've robbed me, but you say, how have we robbed you? In tithes and offerings, you're cursed with a curse. You've robbed me, even this whole nation. You bring all the tithes into the storehouse that there may be food in my house. And test me therefore herewith, says the Eternal of Hosts, if I will not open to you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall be not room enough to receive it." You see, until we've tithed, the money doesn't become ours. That's part of the rule, because we've just read Psalm 24, that the earth is the Eternal's and the fullness thereof. Everything that's in this earth is God's. And therefore we've got to tithe. We've got to be able to tithe. And if we don't tithe, then it's not that we've stolen the tithe from God. We don't steal the tithe from God. None of the money is ours. The entire amount is no longer ours, because the earth is the Eternal's and the fullness thereof. And the way in which the wealth will then pass to us, the 9/10 will pass to us, is if we go ahead and faithfully pay the tithe. And again, this is brought out by Mr. Armstrong very, very clearly in not managing your personal finances, the other one, ending your financial worries. Ending your financial worries. But within this system, that is one way in which we can then give what is ours. Until we've tithed on it, it's not ours to give. Now, obviously, if somebody is coming into the church for the first time, the debt that we have to God is paid and cancelled by the death of Christ. And if we therefore find ourselves in a position where we haven't been tithing properly, we therefore, we, you know, if we need to start from a certain point on repentance, that debt is paid, and therefore you start, and you, repentance doesn't mean just being sorry. It means turning and going in the right direction. But we don't go back and try and make up past tithes. We don't go try and, neither do we go back and try and get circumcised. You know, it's the same principle is involved there. But before any income becomes ours, we should be tithing. We should be tithing on it. And then the whole amount of the 9/10 to the left then is ours. Otherwise, the whole 10/10 remains the eternal's, because the eternal, the earth is the eternal, and the fullness thereof, everything that's in it, the whole lot. And that eventually is going to be given to the saints of the Most High. Now, last week, if we turn over to Romans 13, I pointed out that here in Romans 13, in the context of verse 6, it says, "For this reason pay tribute also, and the God's ministers attending continually render to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute," that means, you know, taxes, paying taxes, custom to whom custom, we've got customs duties as well, "fear to whom fear, honour to whom honour, owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loves another has fulfilled the law." Now, we love God with heart, soul, and might, and we love our neighbour as ourself. That debt is always there. But the aim that we need to have is that we don't owe any man anything. That is the aim. That is what we're aiming for. Now, the problem is, what about mortgages? How can somebody possibly afford a house without a mortgage? And that is true. That is, how can somebody possibly afford a house without a mortgage? Let me ask you a question in this subject of mortgages, because somebody had a word, you know, got in contact with me and said, "Look, if you're talking about avoiding debt, but what about mortgages? You didn't make it clear." I said, "Okay, fine, I'm getting on to that area." And yet the idea was that, well, mortgages are all right. Mortgages aren't a problem. Well, that is not the way of God. That is not the way of God at all. Let me ask you a question. Is it right to work with a homosexual? Is it right to work with a homosexual? Well, the answer is no. It's not right. There's nothing right about it. But the problem is, if we're going to work, we've got to. It's the fact that homosexuality is wrong. That is the problem. And therefore, it's not right to work with a homosexual. If we need to avoid it, we need to avoid it. But we can't avoid it. If you're working in an office and there are people there that are homosexual, then you can't avoid it. You've still got to work with them. You've still got to interact with them. And there's nothing really that we can do about that subject. I know this is what we find. If we turn over to 1 Corinthians 5, it's just out of interest. 1 Corinthians 5, looking at this principle again. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 9. It says, "I wrote to you an epistle not to company with fornicators. Yet not altogether with the fornicators of this world, or with the covetous, or extortioners, or idolaters, or homosexual for that matter, or for those, for then must you needs go out of the world." In other words, you can't avoid doing that with people in the world, because otherwise you've got to get completely out of the world. You've got to completely avoid any interaction with anybody. And that's not what he was talking about. In the same way, I say, you know, is it right to work with a homosexual? No, it's not right, but it's unavoidable when you're in this world. So I ask the other question, is it right to have a mortgage? Well, no, it's not right to have a mortgage. It's not, because there won't be any more mortgages in the world tomorrow. Land will be owned by the families and will be given as an inheritance. So you don't need to go out and get a mortgage. It's not the right way to go about things. But in today's society, how can you possibly own a house without doing that? Well, sometimes you can, but the problem is the moment you do do that, then there's a problem. Turn over to Proverbs 22. The little verse. But boy, does it have an awful lot to say to us. In Proverbs 22, in verse 7, it says, "The rich rules over the poor." And that is true. That is true. If you've got money, you've got power. Money is power. In fact, most of the people that are rich are not rich because they're wanting the money, but they're wanting the power that that money will give them. In many, many cases, that is what they've been seeking. And this is the point, the borrower is a slave to the lender. You know, anybody in debt, you get that verse and you put it up on your fridge. Proverbs 22, verse 7. The borrower is a slave to the lender. So is it right to have a mortgage? No, it's not right to have a mortgage. But in this society, it's unavoidable in most cases. It's unavoidable. But you know, is it just something that we say, oh, well, therefore it's all right. It doesn't really make any difference. It doesn't really have an impact. Well, it most certainly does have an impact. The moment you sign away, whether it's a mortgage, whether it's a loan, whatever you borrow, if you are borrowing money, the moment you sign, you become a slave. We become a slave from that very act. And that verse means what it says. And it is interesting that, you know, you look at house prices. And I'll tell you this much, as far as this present situation that we find ourselves in, as far as the present position of housing and what's going to happen in the housing market. There was an article in the Telegraph. This was Tuesday, this past Tuesday. Okay, house prices are on their way back to long-term rises, say forecasters. House prices will start to recover next year and rise by a sixth by the middle of the decade, according to a forecasting group. And the article then goes on. That's Tuesday. In the same paper, I didn't actually put the position, actually page number, I didn't make a note of that. But in that same paper, another headline, borrowers shift $60 billion to risky mortgages. $60 billion in the UK alone has been shifted to a different type of mortgage. It says up to 300,000 cash-strapped households have switched more than £60 billion of mortgage debt from repayment to risky interest-only deals over the past 3 years to help cover their living costs. So that's what... Why have they had to do that? Well, because they can't afford to pay them. If they can't afford to pay them and they start defaulting on them, then what happens to the housing market? It says, although the move may help families with their immediate cash flow problems, concerns have been raised about how the debts will be repaid. So, are house prices on the way back to the long-term rises? Or is it something different? That was on Tuesday. On Wednesday, the following day, another headline. Banks use soft terms to conceal the bad debt. So who is actually being affected by this bad debt? Well, it's the banks that are affected by it. They reckon they've got all this money on their books, but in fact it's a bad debt. They don't have this money, and they want the house prices to go way back up. They'd love that to happen, because they can sell at a profit and get some other poor sucker to go ahead and take the loan, the mortgage. It says the city watchdog has accused Britain's banks of moving struggling mortgage customers onto more lenient terms to conceal bad debts. So where's this come from? You wonder where this headline about house prices on the way back up has come from. Who actually funded, had somebody do this survey and came out with the conclusion that was there? Because it says the city watchdog accused the Britain's banks of moving struggling mortgage customers onto more lenient terms to conceal bad debts. Lender forbearance, where banks shift home loaners onto interest-only deals, extend their mortgage terms, or even permit payment holidays, now accounts for, now listen to this, 63% of all troubled home loans, according to the Financial Service Authority. So 63, no, it's not all home loans, but of all troubled home loans. Although forbearance can help households, the FSA is concerned the banks are using it to flatter their numbers by reducing bad debt provisions. So, again, that was on Wednesday. And on Thursday, That's a couple of days ago. Another headline, Black Day for Economy Jolts Recovery Hopes. So on one side, you see house prices are on the way back up because of long-term rises, say forecasters. 2 days later, Black Day for the Economy Jolts Recovery Hopes, Manufacturing Slumps, Mortgage Approval Falls, Shares in UK and US Lose Ground, Pound Tumbles. Hopes for, it goes on, he says, hopes for an economic revival suffered a sharp setback yesterday as activity in the vital manufacturing industry slumped to levels last seen during the recession. Mortgage approvals crashed to a record low for April. Britain was now officially declared one of the gloomiest nations in the world. Well, we've always been one of the gloomiest nations in the world, I think. But it is interesting when you see these headlines, and I say, four headlines in a sequence of days, who do you actually, you know, where are you going to make your decision on? What are you going to make your decision on? So you've got a house to buy, and you've got, say, supposing you've managed to save up 100,000, or say, and you want another 100,000 mortgage to go ahead and pay for the £200,000 house. What happens? We read it all about Greek debt, didn't we? What happens then if the anticipated problems in Greece, that you end up therefore with, instead of a £200,000 house, supposing that the actual house prices halve and you end up with £100,000. What does this verse tell us in Proverbs 22? That the rich rule over the poor. You're the one that borrowed the money. You borrowed the £100,000. You thought you had a £200,000 house. But in fact, now it's only worth £100,000. The negative equity has knocked it back to that degree. And the borrower is a slave of the lender. So who's got the house? It's not you. Unless if you are unable to make those mortgage payments, then the bank will foreclose. They will sell that house for half the amount that you paid for it. And that half is the money that you thought you had invested. And the whole lot is wiped off. A whole lot is wiped away. So, although yes, the aim is to owe no man anything except love, and that is the aim. In the practicality, it's not possible in today's society. They've made it not possible. They made it even to the point where you have to have two people working to be able to afford a home, quite frankly. And so you get the kids being fostered off into childcare. And the entire system is becoming worse and worse and worse in that direction. Everybody's greed. They're trying to get more and more for the actual money. You know, a £200,000 house. Is a house worth £200,000? Is it? I mean, what can you build a house for? £60,000? You can build a really, you know, a nice place for £60,000. So where's the value gone? What about the plot of land? £2,000 an acre? £1,000 an acre? Say £2,000 an acre. And you haven't got an acre plot, I can guarantee you that, because you wouldn't be getting it for £200,000. So you've got a portion of an acre. How much is the land actually worth in an agricultural sense? Well, not even worth £1,000. So what have you actually got? £61,000? £51,000? Something like that. But you're being charged £200,000. Why? Because everybody is trying to get more and more and more money out of it, and they know I'll put it into property and the property will go up. And yes, because everybody wants it, that's exactly what's happened. But the moment you get a depression, that goes into reverse. It goes into free fall. It goes back to what the land is worth and what you can build a property on. And in a depression, the actual building cost is less. Why? Because people are desperate for jobs and they'll take jobs at half the price. So instead of being, say, £60,000, you might be £40,000. You might, and again, people will start selling properties again, even less than that. So the housing market tends to collapse in a depression. So all this idea that, oh, there's no problem in getting a mortgage. Don't you kid yourself. Don't you kid yourself. In today's society, in today's economic climate, it could well be. Now, the danger is we'd have a depression, and then you'd have, because of the quantitative easing that they've been doing, the money value would be worthless, the actual cash in. So if you've got cash, then yes, you probably best have invested in something real. If you've got a cash and you're renting, well, I don't know. I'm not even sure about that, and well, that's a good move, quite frankly. Because the chances are, if you buy using that cash, then your cash is going to be worth that much less if the house price collapses. We're in a very different ballpark than we were, say, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years ago. It's not the same way as it was at all. And taking on a mortgage, yes, in today's society, there's not much else that people can do. But you be aware that the rich rule over the poor, and the borrower, including somebody who takes out a mortgage, is a slave to the lender. And that is what God has allowed to be placed within the Proverbs, to give us the wisdom that we need to make sure that we go into such deals, go into such areas with both of our eyes wide open. And this is the point. It's not that you can't borrow money, that we should never borrow money. Mr. Armstrong had to borrow money. But if you go back and you actually see the articles, the co-work letters, the Worldwide News and various things that he wrote in the 80s, where he was overjoyed that he did not have to borrow money at that time. He got himself onto a cash footing. He got the entire work on a cash footing. And that is the legacy that we were left. It is not the idea that, oh, it's all right for the work to go out and borrow money. That's not the legacy that we were left. That is not what God says. He says, no man anything. That's the aim. It is looked upon consistently, Deuteronomy 28 and other areas, as a curse. It's part of the curses to borrow money and to be in debt. And the problem is, as I said last time, is that I've seen people who have come down and had money to actually buy a house outright. And because of mismanagement, had to go out and get a mortgage because they mismanaged the money, because for the first time in their lives they had all this money and therefore they went out and spent it. And they hadn't got a house at the time. They were looking around for a house. I remember, as I said last time, another individual who bought a house that was way over what they needed. The actual family didn't need the size of a house at all. But they looked upon it as an investment. Then certain things went wrong, and they ended up having to sell it. And I think that I've got a sneaking suspicion they might even have gone bankrupt in the process. But the borrower is a slave to the lender, and we always need to make sure we keep that in mind. Now, I talked about, you know, trivialities like phones and iPhones and cable TVs and all this kind of thing. And it is so tempting to go out and waste our money on many things like this. Now, there's no problem if we've got the money to spend and we had, you know, budgeted for it. There's no problem with having an iPhone. There's no problem with having a cable TV, broadband. Broadband, quite frankly, is needed when you've got working from home. I mean, it really is. In most cases, it's far, far better to have broadband. But if you are in debt, look at some of these things. There's no problem with having a new car. There's no problem with having a home. But if you have to go into debt to do it, understand that this chapter 22 and verse 7, the rich rules over the poor and the borrower is a slave. Don't ever forget that. Always remember that. This is true also. One thing I didn't mention and I should have mentioned last time, or needs to be mentioned now, is family planning. You know, people have, you know, children one after another, and they can't afford it. And quite frankly, family planning is part. God plans His family. Look at what He's done. We were coming into the day of Pentecost in another week, and He has planned His family. He knows that He have a certain number, and they will be ready then at a particular time. The entire earth is under the sway of Satan. They will be ready. They will be ready to then administer the government of God, and including the financial areas as well, having learnt within this present system and having overcome and be prepared and in a repentant frame of mind, ready for that kingdom to come. And then the next group will be in the millennium, and there'll be not untold millions, but there'll be a substantial number within the millennium. And there'll be sufficient numbers then at that time to be ready for the Great White Throne Judgment. It is a planned family, very much a planned family. And yet, many times we'll have children when we can't afford them. Now, accidents happen. Accidents do happen. But we should be aware that it is something that God does expect us to be responsible over. And we should, in fact, plan our families. And we shouldn't go ahead and be in a situation where we can't afford to provide for the families. So God gives what is His. He has, I mentioned last time about a capital fund, a cushion. If we're in debt, we need to, one of the things which is a very good idea to get into is the habit of paying cash for things and building up a capital fund, an actual fund of capital, a fund of money that we can actually then use to pay for things is certainly something that is, we should try and do. Now, we've been reading in Malachi 3 about tithing and how before any income is ours, we should in fact be paying the tithe. And if we're going on to the next point about how God is generous, yes, but he accounts for everything, he accounts for every atom. It's very much a case of basing the fact of accounting on the subject of first tithe. I mean, how do you assess your first tithe? How is it assessed? You've got to have some form of accounts. You've got to have some kind of record, something to in order to be able to determine how much money is coming in. If you're in business, certainly, how much money is going out. And incidentally, if I can just mention a little bit about business first tithe, one of the best ways that people have found to handle that is where you have two accounts. One is a personal account and one is a business account. And then when money moves from your business account into the personal account, that's the point in which you tithe on. You tithe on that money then. And then at the end of the year, when your final accounts are drawn up, you then make any balancing that's necessary. Should money have been put into the business, I mean, people say that's fine, but what happens if you start losing money? If you actually start, you have bad debts, and you know, what do? You still got to live. You still got to draw money out of the business, but do you therefore tithe on money that you, when you're going further and further into the hole? Well, when you first start the business, you put money into the business, and that is your capital that you put money in the business. Now, money will then be taken out of the business, but if you then start taking down that capital, that money is yours. You're just simply taking capital out of the business. And so if you're actually drawing down your capital, then obviously you wouldn't tithe on that capital. But it's got to be the capital that you're drawing down on, not some money that you've earned and is there within the business that you happen to take across into your personal account. So That as far as the first tithe is concerned, but you've got to have accounts to be able to do this. You've got to know that initial capitalization of the business. You've got to know that money was put in. It was put in for a certain time, it was a certain amount that went in there. Without accounts, you can't assess what your first tithe is if you have a business. And in a similar way, when you're looking at God's mindset, He does. He has an accounting system which is absolutely incredible. Turn over to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew, just remind ourselves here. Matthew chapter 10. It says, verse 28, "Fear not them which kill the body, are not able to kill the life, the soul, the breathing creature that we are, but rather fear him that is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a farthing? And not one of them shall not fall to your ground without your father, but the very hairs of your head are all numbered." His accounting system is incredible. As I say, you've got a chemical reaction, and in a chemical reaction, matter cannot be either created or destroyed in a chemical reaction. The atoms themselves are, I mean, you look around here, I mean, every single thing that we see is based on what? Electrons, protons and neutrons at a base level, and from that fundamental, you know, alright, it's Bohr's theory of the atom, it's not the understanding that we have today, that it's more complicated than that, but at a base level, you know, you can talk about quarks and muons and all the rest of it, they all fit together into that basic structure. And everything that we see here in the room and in the outside, everything, it rests on that fundamental pattern of proton, neutron and electron. And yet you have this huge variety. And at the same time, it is all absolutely accounted for. Matter doesn't get created, matter doesn't get destroyed in a chemical reaction. Now, it does within the solar system, it does within a nuclear reaction. But even there, when you get down to it, the energy coming out and the matter being destroyed is in distinct balance. It's E equals MC squared. You can put specific formulas into it. You know, God is the master accountant. There is no question about that. And as he says and puts it to us in very, very simple language, two sparrows sold for a farthing, and one of them shall not fall to the ground without your father. He knows that when even a sparrow falls. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. It's not just that he knows how many you've got, but every single one is numbered. It's all accounted for. It's all taken care of. To the point that he knows, you know, he wants to go into his database and know how many hairs, you know, I said before, you know, some people have got more problems than others, but it is all numbered. If we go over to Proverbs 27, it says, and this is the instruction to us. It says in verse 23, be you diligent to know the state of your flocks and look well to your herds. Now, we need to know. I mean, I always remember hearing one account at one time. It was a farmer was up on the North York Moors, I think it was, and he found this guy getting one of his sheep, one of the farmer's sheep, and putting it in the back of the car. He said, what are you doing? You're pinching sheep. He says, well, you've got so many, I wouldn't have thought you'd miss one. And he was quite indignant at the fact that he was going to miss one. But, you know, farmers do know the state of their flocks and herds. And if they don't, then they've got some real serious problems on the hands. You'd be diligent to know the state of your flocks and look well to your herds. You'll see these farmers sometimes, the Land Rover parked up against the gate, and the farmer just there on the end of the gate with his elbows on the gate. What's he doing? I mean, is he having some time off? The chances are no. And it's not a case of, you know, counting legs and dividing by four. It's a case of seeing whether a sheep is limping. Is the foot rot there? Is there one trying to go around and scratch its backside or something? Is there a fly blown in there? And all of this... The farmer will watch and will know what his states of his flocks and herds are. And if you don't, you'll lose them. You'll lose them. I mean, Adele was saying that she had problems with the too rich grass on the young lambs, and the young lambs were starting to die, and the bacteria were fermenting in the gut in a certain way, and it was she didn't step in and do something about it, she would have lost them. She lost two, as he was, and one was very ill. But you be diligent to know the state of the flocks, and look well to your herds. For riches are not forever, and does the crown endure for every generation? The hay appears, and the tender grass shows itself. The herbs and the mountains are gathered. The lambs are for their clothing, and the goats are for the price of your field. And you shall have goats' milk enough for the food, and the food of your household, and for the maintenance of your maidens. In other words, we've got to make sure we know where the money is going, what is happening as far as a business is concerned. And business people, really, if they have a successful business, they know this. They've got to know this. It doesn't have to be that they are super accountants, but they know roughly where they are at the bank. Knowing where they are at the bank is absolutely crucial. That is a crucial aspect, and they do know that. And they've got to make sure they keep a real weather eye on it. And if anybody is in debt, this again is absolutely essential. Before you can start really getting out of debt, and before you can decide how the money is going to be spent, you've got to know how the money is being spent at the moment. It's like time control. You know, the first thing, if you want to make better use of your time, the first thing to do is to keep a time log. And you make a note of you know, every quarter of an hour what you're doing, so you know where the time has gone. You can then plan the time. It's the same with money. You make an accountancy, account of where the money is going, and having seen where the money is going, you can then make a plan as to where you want it to go in the future. I remember one of the best wedding presents that we were given was somebody who was working, Judy was working for, and he said, look, I'll give you, I can't afford to give you a wedding present, but I'll give you a wedding present in kind. Come round to our house and I'll make you a scrambled egg or omelette, wasn't it? We had an omelette over at his house. That basically was a wedding present. But that wasn't all it was. We came over to his house, we had this omelette, and as we were sitting down eating, we were eating round a small table, and he then brought out his budgeting books that he had as his home budgeting books. He says, look, I'm going to teach you how to budget. And he had a page for each category. And it was the case that you could see the accounting of where the money had gone. And that was one of the best wedding presents. I think the one that has served us most, probably the carton of cutlery is still around, but apart from that, I can't really think of much else that has survived. I mean, the glasses have all gone, and the cake went many years ago, and I can't remember anything else that was a wedding present. But this one, which was education, which was knowledge, that certainly has stood us in good stead. And I think back to my own childhood, and one thing I used to do is we had two greenhouses at home, not big ones, fairly small. I say small ones, I'm not talking about tiny, they were 15 foot long and about 6 or 8 feet wide, something like that. We had two of them. One of them my father had, and he had kicked cacti and various things like that, and he let me have the other one. And so I had tomatoes in there, and I'd go down to the local nursery and I'd collect the tomato plants with my pocket money and buy the tomato plants, bring them back and plant them in the greenhouse, and then sell the tomatoes for additional pocket money. And again, my mother would sit me down, and this was as a child of 8, 9, 10, something like that. And sit me down with an exercise book and show me how to do accounts. I would see her doing accounts for the business, every single week she would be doing accounts. And I therefore knew it was important that the accounts were done, but I had no clue, really, as to what I knew basic arithmetic. But it's very simple. You have a date, you have a description, you have in, out, and a balance. And you can see, you have a record of how much you've spent, tomato plants, that would be money going out, so you'd be putting the out column, and then you total, and then you sell the tomatoes, and you have fertilizer perhaps, so money going out for that, and various other bits and pieces that your expenditure is. And then you'd also have the sales of tomatoes, and you might have radishes that you grow initially, because your radishes you can get a crop very, very quickly, a month and you've got the crop, something like that, 6 weeks. And I'd sell bunches of radishes, and again, I'd mark it down in the book. And every so often, you then total up, and you then decide whether you're actually making a profit. You can also see what crops are actually doing better than others. And radishes give a very quick crop. Tomatoes you need a full year in the UK, but you get a better crop. Price-wise than you do out of radishes with tomatoes. And these things I was learning as a 9, 10, 11-year-old child, because my parents sat me down and explained it to me. Now, we need to be teaching this to our children as well. It's not enough just to go ahead and do it ourselves if we are in debt. It is a case of we need to explain it to our children. We need to just take the time to show them very, very simple accounting practices so that they know where their money goes also. And they can make informed decisions accordingly. So God is generous, yes he is, but he also accounts for every atom. Every atom, no atom is destroyed in a chemical reaction. Every atom he knows, he can go, certainly he knows the hairs on our heads, down to that level, it says specifically, but you can see from the natural world that every atom is actually accounted for, because otherwise the entire laws of chemistry would break down. The atoms are certainly accounted for. Now, if we're sliding on from accounts, the next thing is that God does indeed plan ahead, and this is something that we too also need to make sure that we do. It's not just keeping books and keeping a record of what you've spent doesn't really do any good to any of us. You've got to then use that record of what you spent to then say what you intend to spend, what you want to spend, what you're going to spend, and doing a budget accordingly. I mean, what this gentleman gave us as a wedding present, where each page had a specific category, whether it's first tithe, second tithe, housekeeping, rent, fuel, car tax, insurance, repairs, petrol, whatever the various categories were, each one was on a page. I found that cumbersome eventually, and I changed it. I did it for a couple of years, but then I thought, well, I can do a better job than that, and that is by buying one of these multi-column cash books. And a multi-column cash book, I'd therefore have money coming in at the top, and as it came in, it would then be budgeted. So the money that came in, I knew. Supposing you've got. You say your insurance on the car is going to be spent, and it's going to cost you, say, £300. Let's make it a reasonably easy figure for my poor brain. Say £400 it's going to cost you. Is that going to be easier? Because that's 33 and a third, isn't it? So. But all right, 33 and a third, we'll say. So £400 is going to cost you. And each month that you get some money come in, 33 and a third pounds goes across for insurance. And you therefore break out your, if you've got a wage, supposing you've got a standard wage you're earning, you break out your wage and 33 and a third goes into that pot. Now you can do it literally with jam jars. If you have cash and you put it in your jam jars, you can allocate each time the money comes in into the jam jars, and you know that you have enough for that particular whatever the item is when the item becomes due. But by doing it with a multi-column cash book, you have a column for your first tithe, column for your second tithe, column for housekeeping, column for rent, say, for fuel, for car tax or car repairs, or maybe just car. It's dangerous. I would say car is one and petrol is another, because fuel, you can have car, you can eat up all your insurance, and you're then left with no insurance money. So these regular expenses are in one category, and your fuel costs are in another, and then fuel for the home might be another that you need to have a column for. But as the money comes in, you put in the date the money comes in, and then you spread it across, and you put a little bit into each pot. It's almost like little jam jars. Each column is a jam jar, and you're putting an amount in each jam jar, and you total it across, and it is the total at the end, the far end, should be the total that has actually come in at that particular time. Underneath that, you maybe have a third of the book with that money coming in. Two-thirds or more is money going out. So you take the money from where? From the housekeeping. When you pay money to your wife for your housekeeping, it comes out of the housekeeping pot. It comes out of that column. And at the end of each month, you total the amount you got in, which is all the money that's come in, and you have a total of that has been carried forward from the previous month. So you then have a total of all money that has come in and the total that has been there before, total of amounts that went out, and you subtract the amount that went out from the amount that came in, and the total should be the amount of money you've got in the bank. That's the amount you've got in your bank. When you look at your bank statement, you add up all your various accounts, that's the money that you've got in your bank. And so you are actually planning. You're both recording the money that's being spent, but you're also planning into the future as well by saying, okay, insurance we know is going to cost us £400, but that's done once a year, and this is coming in once a month, therefore I need 33 and a third pounds per month that will add up over the course of a year to £400. And this then applies right the way across. So just as accounting, you're accounting in a very similar way to analysing first tithe, because first tithe is giving you the structure on which to base it, the increase, in other words, on which to base it. So budgeting is very much on second tithe, because you put an amount in, a second tithe, 10% every single time, and then you're saving it up until you finally spend it at the end of the year. So the basic principle of breaking out the amount that is there is second tithe. Now, if you look at the way in which the world is going, this is actually coming from WorldNet Daily. It's actually entitled Budget, We Don't Need No Stinking Budget, and basically is saying Congress has defied the law to approve a federal budget since 2009, and Senator Majority Leader Harry Reid is in no hurry to prepare one again, he says. He says there's no need to have a democratic budget, in my opinion, unquote. Reid tells the Los Angeles Times, quote, it would be foolish for us to do a budget at this stage because they're in debt so much. Well, let me say this, that if you're in debt, if we are in debt, that is when you need a budget more than any other time. If you have plenty of money, you can get away with not budgeting. You can get away with not budgeting. If your money coming in and money going out is relatively even. But if you don't, then you need a budget more than anything. In fact, when we were the poorest, I used to budget down to the last penny. But let me say this again, if I can just interject. When you budget, always have some kind of wriggle room. In other words, always have something that you put into your pocket so that you know that, okay, you say £5 a week. You budget, if you're doing it once a month, you get £20 in the month. And that then goes into a jam jar and you take out £5 a week and it goes into your pocket. And you then, if you're going in the shops or whatever, and you see something which you need, if you fancy, you want to buy, you can say, yes, I've got the money, or no, I haven't got the money. And it makes, you're not therefore breaking your budget in order to have something like that. And that again is a principle of budgeting. It is something that we need to understand. But here is the democratic. It says, no need to have a democratic budget, in my opinion, Reid told the Los Angeles Times. It would be foolish for us to do a budget at this stage. In addition, Senator Ken Conrad, DND chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, told reporters that he planned to defer work on a 2012 budget indefinitely. Of course, the absence of a spending plan doesn't mean Reid and his Democratic pals don't want to keep spending. They are nearly apoplectic in their desire to raise the debt limit beyond the $14.3 trillion, so that they can keep on spending without a care as to the consequences, accountability, or revenues. Now, yes, this is written with a Republican slant to it, but it is right. It is a godly slant. You know, if you're in such dire trouble, the last thing you should do is to neglect having a budget. Absolutely last thing you can do. Notice over in Proverbs 22. Proverbs 22, it says in verse 3, it says, a prudent man foresees the evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. Now, if we can, in other words, as I said before, you go to your bank and you see, oh, I've got £500. Oh, wonderful. Well, I think we'll go on holiday. So you go charging off on holiday, you come back and you find that the insurance is due, the rent is due, and everything else is due. You didn't have £500. It is that the prudent foresees the evil. He foresees what is coming in the future. And he hides himself. He gets himself prepared for it. But the simple pass on, and they're punished. And this happens over and over again. And this is actually so important, you can put in your notes, Proverbs 27, verse 12. It is actually repeated, word for word, verbatim. Verse If we go on to Deuteronomy 14, we see the principle involved of second tithe and how that can be applied in the budgeting area. And Deuteronomy 14, verse 22, says, "You shall truly tithe the increase of your seed that the field brings forth year by year. And you will eat before the Eternal your God in the place which he shall choose to place his name there, the tithe of all your corn, your wine, your oil, your firstlings, your herds and flocks, that you may learn to fear the Eternal your God always. And if the way is too long for you, so you're not able to carry it, or if the place is too far for you, which the Eternal your God has chosen to set his name there when the Eternal your God has blessed you, then you will turn it into money, and you'll bind up the money in your hand, and you'll go to the place which the Eternal your God shall choose, and there you'll bestow that money for whatever you lust after, for the oxen, or you know, for steaks, for mutton, for wine, or for whiskey, or for whatever your soul desires, and you'll eat there before the Eternal your God, and you'll rejoice, you and your household." Now that is a basic fundamental principle, and we know, anybody that's kept second tithe understands what a wonderful funny money second tithe is, and it really is. It's wonderful money that you have, this wonderful money that you can spend, even if you're in debt. If you faithfully save the second tithe, it gives the opportunity to be able to actually use money in a way that is, which is wonderful, which is exactly as it should be. Interestingly, let me just quote one, not a scripture, but it's actually from one of the apocryphal works. It's apocryphal. It's Tobit 1. Now, these books are not scripture, they're not canonized, but they are historical books. And this particular one is Tobit, and he actually talks about, this is Tobit talking, and he says in Tobit 1, verse 6, it says, "But I alone went often to Jerusalem at the feasts, as it was ordained unto all people of Israel, by an everlasting decree, having the first fruits and tenths of increase, with that which was shorn, and them which I gave of the altar of the priests of the children Aaron. The first tenth part of all increase I gave to the sons of Aaron, who ministered at Jerusalem. Another tenth apart I sold away, and went and spent it every year in Jerusalem." So there's the second tithe. "And the third I gave unto them to whom it was fitting, as Deborah, my father's mother, had commanded me, because I was left an orphan by my father." So talking about third tithe there. And from Tobit, which is again a historical book, we can see that the second tithe is indeed a second tithe. You can show that quite clearly from the historical book there. But God does indeed plan ahead. And one thing we need to do, I know that somebody was talking to me and said that they had distinct differences when they had prayed about going to the shops and when they hadn't prayed about going to the shops. And this is something else that we need to understand, that if we are budgeting properly, we also need to involve God in that budget and make sure that God is firmly involved. We're doing it for it being right, making sure that it is right, that we're walking in a right way, learning the lessons that are necessary, so that we can then teach those lessons in the world tomorrow. And they went ahead and they sent me this. It says, "When we were on benefits, I'd ask God to bless my hands, that I'd pick up off the shelf what we needed and put back what we don't. And that whenever I did that, I always came home with money left in my purse. And whenever I forgot to involve God in the shopping trip, I'd come back having overspent. Also, when money was so tight, praying before, I allocated the money in the pots and made sure that they all balanced. And so many times the pots would seem to have extra in them that should not have been there. That was just the right amount for, say, shoes, the car repairs, extra electric, or whatever that we simply didn't have the money for. For me, this part of budgeting has always brought me so much closer to God, because it's involving him in a day-by-day level when money is so tight, and literally casting the cares on him on what we're going to eat and wear." And I think that is very applicable and very appropriate. And for anybody that is struggling on a day-by-day basis, make sure we do involve God in the process. It's not just a case of doing our accounts. It's not just a case of making our plans and pointing ourselves forward, the same as any business outside. It is a case that we make and involve God in the budgeting plans. We make sure that we do tithe. We tithe expecting a blessing. You know, as Malachi said, I mean, let's go back and rather than try and misquote it. It talks about how you're cursed with a curse, so you've robbed me even the whole nation. And people don't really understand that our nation is cursed because of that lack of tithing. Our nation is cursed. I mean, I read that they banned, somebody took an injunction out and banned somebody from giving a prayer at a local school gathering or something in the States recently. So some pupil, so it offended his civil rights or whatever, and then put a stop to this practice of having an opening prayer in the school graduation ceremony that had been there for, you know, X number of 100 years. And he says, "You curse with a curse. You rob me, even the whole nation. Bring the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and test me, prove me now herewith, says the Eternal of Hosts, if I won't open the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing that there wouldn't be room enough to receive it." And so if we are doing things which are right, and as I said, the very first point I wanted to bring out is that God does things which are right. He is right. He does things, he is good. He does what is right and which is good. And we should be doing what is right and which is good. And if we are doing that, then we can expect to be blessed accordingly. Now, if we're not, then ask God to show us where we're failing in some way, or to show what the lesson is that we need to learn, whatever it may be. But the entire walk on the financial side is a walk with God. It's not a walk alone. You know, we do make sure we understand that we do indeed walk with God. And when we go into the kingdom of God and the glorious liberty of the children of God, and the budgeting and the various things that we've learned and the walking with God, we are then going to need to pass on these lessons that we're learning with budgeting, of having to go short many times, of having, not quite knowing where the money is coming from. And I remember times when I remember one time that we opened things have arrived in the post that we had no idea where they came from, and it was just the amount needed to match the bill, and nobody knew about the bill that we had at a particular time. Another time we happened to open a container in the cupboard. It was a container in the cupboard, and inside the container was exactly the right money for, what was the bill? Electric or something? It was coal. It was coal, that's right. We needed the money for the coal. We didn't have the money for the coal, and we happened to go in the cupboard, open a container that we hadn't opened for a while, and there was the money inside the container. You know, these things happen. Did God put it there, or did I put it there sometime, or somebody else put it there, or whatever? It doesn't matter. You know, it was provided at the right time. And having done that, we are going into, literally, the glorious liberty of the children of God. We're going to have a family-based society. Family-based society. There's no corporations that we've got today. They just simply aren't going to be there. The Jubilee is going to be there. And it's a land of unwalled villages that will be keeping that jubilee. There's not going to be land speculation. Unwalled villages, the jubilee applies to. In other words, because the jubilee didn't apply into walled towns. The jubilee doesn't apply. You can sell within a walled town, and then if you don't get it redeemed within a year, it passes to the person that bought it. But it's going to be a land of unwalled villages, so the jubilee is going to figure quite prominently, and therefore that means there's no land speculation, there's no planning laws, there's no inheritance tax, there's no huge estates, there's no ranches, you know, with multiple thousands, if not millions of acres. It just isn't going to be there. There's no limited companies, no PLCs, because it's not a family. In a limited company, a PLC is a totally man-made contrivance to go ahead and allow some people to get away with blue murder. And that's not going to be the case. There's not going to be any usury. There's not going to be any inflation. The currency is going to be tied to the land. And it's tied to the land in a very specific way. There's no when I say usury, I don't mean excessive interest. I mean any interest. There's not going to be interest at that time. There's going to be interests outside of Israel, outside the Commonwealth of Israel. Yes, that will be permissible. But then people will therefore look in and see what is happening within Israel and therefore want a part of it and become part of the Commonwealth of Israel accordingly. There's not going to be any long-term debts on the capital side. Why? Because there's a sabbatical year. Every 7 years, the debts are cancelled. So, long-term debts are a thing of the past. There's not going to be banking the way it is today. There's not going to be taxes. there's not going to be VAT, certainly. No value-added tax, no sales tax. The tithe is on the increase. On the increase. It's not on the goods themselves. So, when you see the restitution of all things, as talked about in Acts 3, well, you go back to 1 Samuel 8, where they first had a king. In fact, let's do that. Let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 8. Go over a little bit. It says in verse 6, it says, "But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, 'Give us a king to judge us.' And Samuel prayed to the Eternal, and the Eternal said to Samuel, 'You listen to the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they've not rejected you, but they've rejected me that I should not reign over them.'" So what they did back then is going to be restored. We're going to go back to a system where what we're about to read here doesn't apply. "According to the works which they have done since the day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they do also to you. Now therefore listen to their voice, howbeit let protest solemnly to them. Show them the manner of the king that will reign over them." This is Christ talking to them now, talking to Samuel. "So you tell them really good, and make sure they understand. And Samuel told all the words of the Eternal to the people that asked of him a king. And he said, 'This will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He'll take your sons, and he'll appoint them for himself, for his chariots and his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. And he'll appoint him captains over thousands and captains of fifties, and he'll set them ear his ground and reap his harvest, to make instruments of war and instruments of his chariots. And he will take your daughters to be confectionaries and cooks and bakers. And he'll take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, give them to his servants. And he'll take the tenth of your seed and your vineyards and give it to his officers and his servants. And he'll take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. And he'll take the tenth of your sheep, and you shall be his servants. And you'll cry out in that day because of your king that you've chosen. You, the Eternal, will not hear you in that day." Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, "No, we'll have a king over us." Yeah, right. And so we've got the situation today. But the tithe is on increase. Okay, final scripture, Revelation 18. Revelation 18. Because this is a Babylonish system that we're in today. As I said about mortgages, is it right to have a mortgage? No, it's not right to have a mortgage. The trouble is we're living in this wretched system that makes it almost impossible to do anything else to be as well as owning a house except having a mortgage. But be careful, because anybody that borrows money is a slave. And so you borrow as little as you need to. You get it paid back early if you possibly can. If you can. If you can't, then fine. You just have to put up with it. But don't just take the world's view of things, because the world's view is going to radically change. And we're going to have to make sure that the world system, which is based on greed, is fully understood to be part of this Babylonish system, this system of confusion in the economy. And we've got to have a different mindset in the world tomorrow for the kingdom of God. But here in Revelation 18, verse 7, "How much has she glorified herself and lived deliciously? So much torment and sorrow give her, for she said in her heart, 'I sit a queen and I'm no widow, and I shall see no sorrow. Therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire. For strong is the Lord God who judges her.'" And he's talking about Babylon here, remember. "And the kings of the earth that committed fornication and lived deliciously with her shall bewail her and lament when they'll see the smoke of her burning, standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, 'Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that confusion, that mighty city, for in one hour your judgment has come.' And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buys their merchandise any more." So we see this system that is eventually going to collapse. And we see in Daniel that it's going to be given to the saints of the Most High. And it says in verse 1. It says, "And after these things I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. And he cried mightily with a strong voice," this is Revelation 18 verse 2, "saying, Babylon the great is fallen and become the habitation of demons, and the hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies." And it's all based on greed. The whole rotten system is based on greed. And we've got to learn a different way. We've got to learn godly financing. Godly finances within today's society, within today's world, so we can then teach it in the world tomorrow. And it says here, "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that you not partakers of her sins, and that you do not receive of her plagues."